Everybody, we are the Tri-State Sports Guys coming at you live out of Norwalk, Connecticut. It's a little stormy and not so nice out tonight, but I have a nice surprise next to me. The coach, Sean Iron. How you doing tonight, Coach?
I'm doing all right, Daniel. How are you?
I'm fantastic. We're going to get into some World Cup soccer tonight, maybe talk a little free agency, NBA, maybe a little of the Carmelo situation. We might get into a little Yankees talk.
Tiger Woods.
We're going to talk some Tiger Woods.
Drunk Serena Williams.
Drunk Serena Williams. The number to call, as always, 347-637-2306. You can hit us up on Twitter at @tristate_sports. Check the website out anytime. There's some good articles up there, tristatesportsguys.com. First thing I want to get into a little bit, Coach, you played a little golf today.
Yes, I did.
So give me a little rundown of what it was like up there on the links today.
First of all, let's start off by last night. We had a softball game, and we didn't get home until the wee hours of the morning.
Yeah, I was going to leave that out, but yeah. That's okay.
So when I got the text today from a good friend of mine, Pat Moffitt, new father, he said, you want to play golf? The first thing he did was at my phone, it said 84 degrees. I said, I'm in.
Yeah.
It was not 84 degrees today. It was every bit of a buck, man. So my light blue shirt turned into the Michigan blue shirt by the third hole. So anyway, we're walking up, and we got a threesome, and there's this kid there, and young kid, freshman, and we introduce ourselves. Kid from Darien.
Uh-oh.
Couldn't have been nicer, which he nagged all the stereotypes. My question is, how does a kid like that turn out that good, that nice, and then there's you?
That's people back then in this town before. They really have, and I'll tell you this one.
Jack, if you're listening, by the way, great round for that.
Yeah, I mean, good shooting, but I'm going to tell you this one. It was the night before your wedding. I'm having a drink with my fellow co-host, Mike DePalma, and his wife is right next to us. Beautiful, lovely wife, the nicest lady in the world, right?
Yeah, she's all right.
So she says to me, she goes, you know, I was just telling Mike recently, you're so nice, people wouldn't even think you're from Darien. Now, I mean, you can't beat that kind of left-handed compliment. I've never forgotten it. I remember we were in this big, like, you know, what do they call them, with the big high ceilings and all that stuff, and we're standing there and talking with Mike and Harrison. I mean, the fact that Darien is such a crap hole that people feel the need to say that to you, you're so nice, people wouldn't even know you're from the most white bread, snotty, elitist town on the face of the planet. So this kid was a high school kid or a college kid?
Going into sophomore year high school.
Wow. What did you?
He had a couple of nice shots. He had a tough round, but nicest kid in the world. Actually, he saw my power fade for the first time.
Impressive.
So his exact words was, oh, my God.
Yeah. For anybody that doesn't realize, Coach here opens up his stance about 45 degrees. You hit this banana ball, what, about 250, 270? You can clip him, you get him out there more than that?
Yeah.
But you get him out there, and you probably lose 40 yards with the distance, which is probably why you haven't won a major championship right now.
That could be it.
Yeah.
That and because our good friend of the show, John Daly, wants to eliminate the hybrid club, which I need in my bag.
Yeah. But here's the thing, though. John's only got two majors, so, you know, what would he know? But we were talking a little bit before we got in the air. Coach Moffitt there, good golfer, obviously, very good golfer.
Yep.
He's fixing up your game.
Yep.
He's getting you going. Got a little baby fade now, so you're not going to lose all this extra distance.
Right.
And you know what will happen? I'm guaranteeing you this. Before next summer starts, you'll play a little draw. You'll have a little – he'll incorporate a draw in your game.
That would never happen.
And you're going to go with 89 today from the tips.
From the tips, shot at 89 with two off balls.
You see? He'll have you at 81 by next year. That's what happens when you hang out with golfers. It doesn't happen in any other sport.
He dresses sharp on the court, too.
Yeah, and you know what?
Like a golfer.
You mentioned it. New father, young Braden, adorable little kid. He's going to have golf in his blood.
Yeah.
We could be looking at a multiple-time major champion right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, this is all great. We were going to get into the World Cup, but I feel like we're at a point here where we can perfectly segue. We'll cover a little bit of my main man, Tiger Woods. Now, I'm interested to get your thoughts on this because, I'm a guy who can't play golf a lick, as you can attest to.
Yep.
But I follow the game. I love it. I think it's so much fun watching those guys that are that good. He goes to the Quicken Loans National, Congressional Country Club, this past week, Thursday, Friday, missed the cut. He shoots a back-to-back 74-75, right? Hasn't played in 16 weeks, okay? And the other thing to that, the little addendum to that is, when he was coming back, he'd been taking full shots for 2 weeks. He practiced, he said, no excuse, he goes, but I've been practicing on Bermuda, and this is ryegrass. It's a huge difference, so I'm happy with where I was. But people like, it seems like the better you are, the faster people write you off. It's amazing to me. Like, people don't write off Bubba Watson because he's hot right now. Tiger has 12 more majors than Bubba, but Tiger shoots back-to-back, 3-4 over par, misses the cut, and he stinks. So he also announced his next appearance will be at the Open Championship, July 17th through 20th, Royal Liverpool and Hoylake, UK. He's the leader on the betting boards. Now, if a guy is done, which is the word Randall Chandler used on the Golf Channel, he looks, you don't have him at 6-1. I understand they have to protect themselves. You can't have Tiger go up to 50-1 because everybody was paying. So you got to protect yourself. But you watch this guy play. Is he done? I mean, is he done winning majors right now, even money you're betting? You're going to bet against him to win a major, another major, two majors, whatever?
I think this year he has no shot at major.
None.
No shot this year. Now, get back into the groove of things. Does he, you know, does he fix some things up and, you know, do what he needs to do? I guess in the offseason, I don't know what the hell they call it. But this year, I don't think he has a shot.
None. Even with the fact that the final two majors, you got the Open Championship, you got the PGA, are not only on courses he's played, they're courses he's won those particular majors on. In Liverpool, and then they're going to go to Valhalla in August in Kentucky and contest the PGA there. Even given the fact he's won majors on both these courses, you just figure
it's time.
He's done.
Yeah.
Because he's not right or his game is off. He's not healthy. What are you looking more at?
One, his game isn't there. When does Tiger Woods miss a cup? You know what I mean?
10th time.
But how many times has he done it recently? It's starting to happen more often. Where if you said he missed a cut 3 years ago, it would have been on the back page, you know, holy cow. Now it's just, oh, Tiger missed a cut. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just think I'm not saying he's bad. I'm not saying he's the worst golfer in the world. But I'm just saying as far as contending for a major this year, no.
I'm going to run this by you. And I wrote a little article, sportsguys.com, about Tiger, about how everybody's leaving the sports done, he's washed up, he stinks, whatever. The guy's the PGA Tour Player of the Year last year.
Mm-hmm.
He won 5 times. And I know this is before his most recent back surgery. You know, he's obviously had the knee operation and all these things. He's been kind of bitten by the injury bug. But the guy still wins. So for all the rhetoric, and maybe it's just semantics, but for all the rhetoric that he does not win, it's false. I think what people should say is he has not won a major since the U.S. Open in 08, right? But still wins tournaments. He wins them at a higher rate than anybody in the world, which if you're using that as your barometer, which I'm not, but if you are using that as your barometer for how good a guy is, you can still say he's the best player in the world. Even just relative to the last 2 years, you could say he's probably still the best player in the world, but everyone writes him off. Now, some part of me agrees with you that he probably will not win one of his next two majors because his game, you said it's not there. But if he goes to Hoylake and has his B-plus game, he's going to be, in all likelihood, unless they get a Martin Keimer type 2 days that gets the guy a 10-shot lead or whatever, he's going to be in one of the last couple groupings. That's what his B-plus game, that's where he'll be. You don't think he can get there over the next few weeks saying he's healthy, he's saying he feels healthy, that he'll at least be physically able to play this.
He'll be physically able to play. Yeah, unless he's lying. I don't know. You know, I don't know why he's lying. Golf is not like, you know, a defenseman. Right. But it's not like a defenseman could come in, like, take you out because you're disclosing an injury.
Right.
But I just don't see it. I just haven't seen enough of it this year. I just don't see it. And I could be wrong.
Here's what I'm willing to say, right? If I'm over in the U.K., and I go into one of those betting parlors. For anybody that doesn't know, it's legal. You can go in there. There's parlors from London to Liverpool. You go in, place your bet. There's some of them that have him as high as 9-1. I'm telling you, 6-1, I put $100 on Tiger in a second. In a second. I understand that's with gambling. I'm taking a shot. I'm not saying he's probably not the favorite if you look at who's hot right now. He's clearly not. And I mean, you're going to put Keimer, you're going to put Bubba, you're going to put Scott or Mickelson or whoever. The guy is still well worth a shot at 6-1. He's worth every bit the shot at 6-1 that Mickelson is at 18-1.
I think Mickelson's another one who's
Done? Really?
Yeah.
No more no, majors?
He's my favorite golfer. Not even close. Like, it's frustrating to watch him because he'll go birdie, birdie, bogey, 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 birdie. He's the most frustrating golfer to watch right now.
I got a great question for you now because I'm always enamored. I like Phil. I think Phil is – he's overrated in the same sense Tiger is. Like, you know, they're both great, but people talk about Phil endlessly, right? So he goes over last year, and he wins the Open Championship, which, honestly, he said was a championship that he never thought he'd win. I never thought he'd win it. He plays the high ball. He does all those things. He curves it so much. He has nothing. He really plays well. And around the green, he doesn't play any kind of bump-and-run shots or whatever. So he goes over there at Muir Field, which is a place that every guy that's won the Open is in the Hall of Fame. There's Phil, another guy in the Hall of Fame, wins it, right? You write him off there, the U.S. Open now, six times finishing second. You go, he'll never get that. But you know what? He's just crazy enough that he probably will.
Mm-hmm.
He'll probably find a way to win it. And I also think, and I've gone on the record with buddies of mine that talk golf, and I said, I still think he'll win the Masters at least one more time, maybe two. The course now that we see it with him, Watson, Mike Weir, sets up for lefties. Steve Flesch is another guy who never won a major but finished top 10 there a handful of times as a left-hand player. I mean, how does Phil not get eight majors with tie in with Tom Watson? And Tom is my favorite. This guy grew up, like, loving Tom Watson. Never thought I'd live to see the day someone would win that many majors. Here's Tiger now with six more than him. Phil's got to win just three more. He's, what, 44, 43?
I don't know how old he is.
So you're saying – You have no confidence in Phil finding another way. Just think about Augusta for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think he gets around that track one more
no,
time without a green jacket?
He could. I don't know.
You're ruling him out. And he's your guy.
He's my guy. Put it this way. It wouldn't shock me if he didn't. It wouldn't shock me if he did. You know, I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
I'm saying this. I think Phil, right now, he's got five. Obviously, everybody's talking about the U.S. Open to finish the career slam. I think he'll get it. I think he'll find a way. Next year, they're going out to Washington. I think to Erin Hills or something like that. People are talking about if another course sets up like Augusta for a lefty. You know, he can play the draw shots, do all those things. The Masters, I still think he gets another one or two, maybe. He's so good there. He's so consistent, three times a champion there. The PGA, he won once at Paul Petrol down in Jersey. He plays different courses well. And then last year when he was – I'm watching Sunday. What we had to get up at like 8 in the morning it came on or whatever. And you're watching this, you're going, this son of a – he's going to win this thing. Everybody's falling apart. And then there's Crazy Phil. Just puts up the shot, what, 57 on Sunday on a course that was not giving up anything under 70? I mean, he's unbelievable. And now you've got him and Tiger. They're still, no matter where you go, what major it is, those two are still in the betting odds, top three, top four, every single time. But we write, that's, I think, to my point, if I may say so, like, we write off the really good guys. We write off those guys, and then all of a sudden, you know, Webb Simpson is a contender somewhere because he played well at the John Deere. Why? Why does he matter? You don't even have a theory on it.
No.
You don't?
No theory. I shouldn't say that. I think that this young group of golfers coming up are that much better. Before Tiger was up here, everybody was down here. Those young golfers are very good. Where if they were around when Tiger, like if they all came up at the same time, I bet you Tiger wouldn't have as many majors as he does now.
See, I differ with you there because I'll say this. These young guys you're talking to, and I agree with you, the old guys, Nicholas Watson, Palmer, all those guys say that this is the best crop of young, under 25 players they've ever seen in the game. So those guys know a lot more than I do, so I'm going to take their word for that. But none of these guys, whether you want to talk about Spieth or, you know, Kiner's 29, I mean, he was around for some of Tiger's stuff, but I'm talking the early 2000s, win the U.S. Open by 15, win the Masters by 16, Tiger Woods. They never saw that. They never had to encounter that themselves. I think, in all honesty, and I thought it for a while, that I think Tiger killed confidence on tour with how unbelievably dominant he was. because he also has a litany of top twos and threes where he was right there, and I mean, he blew the PGA to Y.E. Yang and whatever that was, 07 or 8. I mean, to your point, if someone stole one or two of those 14, if he could have stole one or two of the other ones, then he was right there. But I think there is a crop of players now we're seeing where you're going, wow, I mean, who's more fun to watch than Jordan Spieth? He's absolutely awesome. But there's nobody on tour right now that's just destroying everybody else. I mean, Keimer at the U.S. Open is an anomaly. Bubba now's got two green jackets, and you go, I mean, that's impressive. But there's nobody sitting there right now with 5 or 6. You think of Tiger and Phil, the next biggest one is Ernie Els. And everybody thinks Ernie's done. All he did was win an Open Championship 3 years ago, but, you know, he all of a sudden stinks now. So you got this really interesting point we're at with the PGA Tour right now where you said there's a million contenders. And when Tiger was right, you looked at it and you said, if he goes to the tournament and plays well, he's going to win.
But can't you say that about the young guys now?
But who? McIlroy?
McIlroy, Bubba Watson.
Well, Bubba's older than I. That's an internet. Bubba's 36.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Wow, that shows how much I know.
Yeah, I mean, so Bubba's that guy. Bubba's come out of nowhere. And the interesting thing with him is in that 2010 PJ, that Keimer won, that was up at the Whistling Straits when they had the horrible ruling on Dustin Johnson. You would have never thought that was eventually won by Keimer. You would never be thinking 4 years later when you're sitting there looking at him and Watson in that playoff, and they would each have two major championships.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely staggering because I'm looking at it at the time. I remember watching the tournament going, we're never going to see these guys again. And I remember Bubba, like, he just lost the PGA Championship. He looked at his dad and he goes, did I make the Ryder Cup? Because the only thing he was concerned with was his father is a former Army Ranger, a Green Beret. He's very patriotic. And all he wanted to do was play for the U.S. Ryder Cup side. And you're looking at that going, when are we ever going to see a guy again who's not even heartbroken? He just lost it. Like, you didn't think he had the gumption. He's got two Masters. Keimer wins that and the 2014 U.S. Open. He's 29. And the only multiple major champions under the age of 30 right now are him and McIlroy. So for all the winning that is so spread out across the board, there's still not one guy who's made 4, 5, 6 or any kind of run, forget Tiger, any kind of run towards Mickelson. You know? So we got a lot of that stuff going on. But we're going to take a quick break.
Tell you what.
Go ahead. Tell me what first.
Tiger or Phil, they wouldn't have shot 89 at the Open with tips in today's conditions.
What do you think they shoot there? Tips.
60?
Tops. Yeah.
I mean, just on the front nine, the front seven, they could probably drive all those greens, all those par fours. The par five, the eighth hole, the par five, they're probably driver 8-iron into the par five. The ninth hole is the long par four for us.
They're driving 18.
They're driving 18. The 10th hole, they're there into the 11th hole. They're probably drawing it around the trees.
Yep.
The 15th hole, they're there. 12, they're there. It would break six.
Yeah, and it would be upsetting.
Yeah.
It'd be cool if you said I played with Tiger and Phil at Oak Hill, but at the same point, I mean, we're sitting here before the show talking about you getting down in the low 80s and Coach Moffitt helping you out. It would break your heart to shoot 81 and watch a guy shoot 58. I mean,
yeah.
It would be a cool experience for you, but at the same time, listen, we're going to take a quick break, Coach. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little World Cup. Neither one of us is an expert, but I'm sure we both have our theories on what's going on with the World Cup. So we will be right back. We're going to try to stay courtside.
Hey, it's Shy Roslyn. And I'm inviting you to visit my new shop, Pond's Edge Designs by Rosalind Brunson. My motto is fun, funky, and affordable. Wearable art for men, women, and even home decor items. All handmade in the USA, every item one of a kind. Don't be shy, stop by. PondsEdgeDesigns.net.
Well, Coach, that was the lovely Shy Roslyn, her show goes on after us. She does all kinds of little knickknacks, interesting things. Figure we give her a little shout-out as we do from time to time. We're going to get in now to, for any of our listeners that are into soccer or football, whatever you want to call it. We call it soccer here. We're going to get in a little bit of the World Cup loss yesterday to the Belgian team. Coach, I want to get your take on it because I'm the first one to admit, as I did before we went to the break, I don't know too much about soccer. I know, like, four rules. I know there's a lot of flopping around. Can't use your hands. Although I think there was a big stick about that years ago with Maradona. He just stopped the ball with his hands. Whatever. Did you ever think watching that game, as the game was going on, before anything was scored, did you ever get the feeling we were going to win that game?
No.
For like a single second.
The only time is when that dude missed the open net in stoppage time.
Right.
That's the only time.
Yeah.
You know what it reminded me of? If you're going to get happy about this. You know when a hockey team's on the power play?
Yes.
And they are just firing shots at the goal, and you're just saying, all right, eventually these are going to – that's how – and our goalie.
Unbelievable.
Ridiculous. But that's what it felt like. Shot after shot, and you're like, one of these is going to go in, just when is it going to happen? But, yeah, that's – but I never saw – before the game, I thought we had a chance, but I don't know anything about Belgium. The only thing I heard about Belgium, I guess, size of Maryland. That's what they said before the game. So that gave me a little hope. But no, Maryland beat the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about that is when I'm watching some of these soccer games, I'm saying to myself, you know what? It's the American in me. It comes out and I go, these are like nowhere close to our best athletes. But just about everybody we're playing, I mean, I know there's exceptions everywhere, but I watched this when we played the Germans on goal. It's because they all play soccer. Like, there's, you know, you get your Dirk of the season, you get your Detlef Schrempf and the guys in the NHL from Germany. But this is what seemingly all the great athletes in every other part of the world other than here in Canada seem to play is this world football. And so it's upsetting to me on that level to watch, like, the rest of the world kind of look down their noses at us in my mind. Maybe that's just me being, you know, the Americanized part of me. But I'm watching that game, and you're using an NHL analogy. I'll use a football analogy. Like, you ever watch Navy when they're playing and they run that option? Even when they're not scoring, those drives, if it's working, they take forever. And what it does is, you know better than I do, it's just taking the wind out of your defense. Then your offense is like, we haven't been on the field in 8 minutes. And they come out, they look rusty. And the whole time, especially as an Army fan, you're watching them run an option and go, eventually, with all this possession. And then they put up the number somewhere around like the 70-minute mark. And it was like 71% of the game, Belgium had the ball. They put up that possession percentage. And you're like, how the hell are we ever going to win a game when we have the ball like roughly a third of the time? How are you ever going to win?
Did you see it? This is why I'm sure the number's not fixed. At the end of regulation, do you know what the percentage was for percentage time of possession?
No.
51% to 49%.
How's that possible?
That's what I'm saying. I don't know how they do. They judge it when if the American guy's hurt, does that count as our possession? Like, I have no idea, but it was 51% to 49%, and I was saying, I'm like, that there's no way that's true.
Belgium literally had that ball. The only time they didn't have the ball is like when they must have felt that and gave it to the American team. But
Tim Howard made it say that's the only time they didn't.
Yeah, I wonder if that counts. Like, all the time he's loading it up to kick it out or whatever. But first of all, that dude deserves some credit because, or at least a little bit of air time. He deserves a lot of credit. That was like, people were talking about the Mexico goalie in the first round, and I saw some of that game. That dude looked like a Jedi saving ball. Tim Howard yesterday looked like, I don't even know. It looked like a god in that. And you're looking at this going, if this was a lesser goalkeeper here, we would be down like 11-0 at the 20-minute mark. But there were just shots coming at him from angles. They were getting
breakaways,
these little run-throughs.
Yep.
Great passes. The kid's, I think his name's like the Brian or the Groin or whatever. Unbelievable. He had like six runs through with clear-up shots. And here's Thomas, and he's kicking his legs and saving balls with his feet. And I'm looking at this going, that has to be frustrating. As someone who, the last time I played soccer, I think I was six. All right? So I don't know what it's like to be in goal. That has to be more frustrating than being a goalie in hockey because you're going, what else can I do? And you guys are down the center of the field the whole time. But don't you think at one point he's looking at his team and says, when you guys get the ball, you know you can go down the other end of the field. Like, you don't have to be down here this whole time. And they were just kicking the ball around like they were playing against 8-year-olds.
How many times did they have the ball right around midfield? No pressure.
Yeah.
And it would be like me trying to pass you. And they kicked it, like, out of bounds, like not even close to the guy.
Yeah.
And I was just sitting there like, these are professional soccer players? Like, nobody was playing defense, trying to pass the ball, and they don't even come close and the ball was out of bounds. And I'm not talking like one of those passes that goes across the field. I'm talking a 20-yard pass, not even close.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was just, it was a deal where you're looking at this going, you know what, and you know, maybe you can disagree with the point. Everybody was talking about after the game. I remember it was Alexi Lalas and then Michael Ballas from Germany. They were kind of, you know, quite former players talking about it. They were talking about all the progress we've made. Okay, as a soccer-playing nation, right? On the field, like that's what their theory was. Like on the field, they're starting to look more, Ballas said, like a European side. All I saw in the games that I watched was the difference in ability level. And, you know, I'm not going to go into, we talked about you and I a little bit last night, you know, Landon Donovan, would he have made a difference? I mean, the point is moot because he's not even there, right? So, you know, I hate people that look at sports that way. He's not there. Clemson made the decision not to put him on the team, right? But do you see us any closer to these last eight teams that are going to play? I've seen them play. I feel like Mike, when he was talking about NHL couples, so like, when I'm watching a good team play, I can tell. I don't know a lot about the sport. That's how I feel about soccer. Like, I don't know enough. But you watch these teams play like Brazil or Colombia or Argentina or whatever, they just look a million times better than us. So how do we – are we close in your mind? Or is it just what it looks like to me, which is we're about 20 miles behind everybody else?
I think we're very behind everybody else. I really do. And everybody's saying, like you just said, we're closing the gap, we're closing. If we didn't have our goalie, we would have lost that match 4-0. And the critics would have been, this is it, you know, whatever. But I was listening to one of our competitors today, Mike and Mike in the morning.
Right.
You know, not to give them a plug, but. And Mike Dolan said it best. He's like, we'll see how far we come in 2 weeks. People are still talking soccer and the MLS is starting to sell out. He's like, okay, we made progress. But he's like, I'll be able to tell you in 2 weeks. And I thought that was a great point. Because right now everybody's saying, yes. We'll see. Don't jump to conclusions yet. We'll see.
See, that is a good point. And I would say I agree with what he's saying. The thing I've already thought about is if for some reason, and I don't foresee this happening, but if for some reason I'm bitten by this hockey bug, soccer bug, I'm not going to watch the MLS.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch a Premier League game between, like, you know, Liverpool and Everton, or I'm going to watch an Italian game between, like, Parma and Milan or something like that, because I think, and I think I'm right when I say this, the MLS is like minor league soccer compared to what those clubs, the elite clubs over there, do. So, I mean, I guess if you're such a patriotic person, you want to get into soccer now, you're going to become a Red Bull fan? Like, I don't know. I don't even know a lot of the team names. I know there's the Earthquakes and the Sounders and whatever. I can't see myself sitting down and watch that because, to me, it's like these are guys that aren't good enough to play elsewhere. So when people start talking about, you know, are we getting big on soccer in this country, I think the answer is a resounding no. It's never going to – It might pass hockey, maybe, but it's never going to get close to football or basketball or baseball.
And somebody else brought up a good point, and I agree with it to some extent. They said they're talking about the ratings, and the ratings on a, you know, Tuesday afternoon beat anything. It had a higher rating than the game one of the World Series, whatever it was. What's my point?
I do that all the time. And you know what Mike does? He just looks at me.
Yeah, like you're doing to me now.
Yeah.
I'll think of it.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing to me is that, like, you get behind it, and it may be, you got enough?
Yeah, I got it.
Go ahead.
What they were saying was they weren't watching a soccer game. They were watching a United States event, a United States competition against the world, and we were in the quarterfinals.
Right.
You know, that's what they were, not that it was soccer. And then somebody brought up, well, it was a curling match, and we were in the club, and they're like, come on, let's not get crazy. But they weren't watching soccer. They were watching, I couldn't, like you just said, if we went to O'Neill's yesterday during the game, okay, and say there were probably 500 people there.
Yeah.
If we pulled all 500, write down 8 Major League Soccer team names, I would say 400 of the people could.
Yeah, I got like 4.
Yeah, I know the Red Bulls, and I think there's
just the Revolution of
right.
New England.
But that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I don't even know how many teams are in there. But so that's what made me agree with what they're saying. We weren't watching soccer. We were just watching the United States competition, a major one, which we were doing well.
Yeah, and, you know, what I was going to say is, for me, I saw a lot of parallels between what a D-bag I was during the Olympic hockey. Because all you do is what you just said. You're correct there. You just get invited because it's the U.S. So I'm watching the guys, and you know what? I'm not going to remember the names other than Howard probably in an hour if you ask me. So I'm honest about it. And I think they're very comparable sports in the sense of how many people actually follow them or understand them between hockey and soccer. But the difference was I wasn't going on Facebook talking about the kind of setup the team was running, and I wasn't sending text messages to the guys I do know who watch soccer saying, like, you were dead wrong about the way this Belgian team plays because I don't know what the hell's going on.
Right.
So I just wanted people during the hockey, you know, the Olympic hockey to admit, like, look, I don't know anything. I'm just watching it. I can't tell you where TJLG plays. I can't even tell you what state he's from. I'm watching it because it's the U.S. And have you beat Canada? That was the question at the time. Like, would hockey catch on? No. No, it would have been big as we went on and played Sweden, but after that gold medal game and then whether we won gold or silver, I mean, everybody would have been just like we are now. Soccer's dead and buried probably in most of our minds. And Coney D tweeted something from Not Bill Walton, which was he had tweeted, like, will soccer catch on in the U.S. now? And he said, you know, I heard the same thing 4 years ago, 8 years ago, 12 years ago, you know. And it's true because teams come around every time we talk about this, every time we talk about the Olympics. Like, are you going to watch, like, 10 years ago? Are you going to watch Michael Phelps when he swims in the Scottsdale Open? You're like, of course I'm not, because there'll probably be golf on that day or whatever, and I'll watch that. So there's these non-Olympic sports in my mind. I know soccer is played in the U21 or whatever. It's just not. It's just not. It's not something that I want to watch Tim Howard play for Everton over in the Premier League or whatever. It's just like, it's cool. We got to go with right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to follow Wadalowski now out in San Jose and see what's going on?
You ever watch Rudy Truman Show?
Absolutely.
Okay. It reminds me of when the show ends. They show the two guys working in the parking garage that are into it. As soon as it ends, they look at each other like, all right, what else is on?
Yeah.
That's exactly what it's like. What else is on?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. And it's great. It's great that the patriotism you see for all the countries in the World Cup, it's great. Was it 32 of them? Yeah, right?
Yeah,
15 good and 15 don't, so 32. It's great to see, and I've said it before, and Michael said last week, well, I'm a sap, and it's true, I am a sap for things like that. I love the national anthem. I love stuff like that. I love seeing the fans all amped up. And there's a lot of good-looking ladies in the stands, too.
Oh, that Brazil? There's something going on down in Brazil.
It's in the water.
There's something going on. They have yet to pan on a Brazilian female fan, and you'd be like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Eight or above.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest, though. I didn't have that problem when, like, the Iran game was on or Russia. I mean, I wasn't as worried about that, but there's some unbelievable ladies there. You know, all the stuff I've seen, Facebook, girls I know talking about how good-looking the players are, like, guys are so sexy and great. It's like, you looking the same? I don't agree to that, but
have they come down to the O'Neill softball game?
They don't like me that much. It's like, you know, I've friends on Facebook.
The same thing.
With who?
About us?
Not if they saw your second NFL. They wouldn't say anything about you. Let's not take a commercial break. Let's just segue right in because we were talking about a little bit before the show. You done with soccer? Anything
we
you want to add?
Yeah.
Mike's sitting behind me and he's just exhausted of listening to soccer talk.
One last thing, and I might get lynched for this, all these true diehards.
Oh, I won't.
One player that annoys me more than anybody is, who's their star player, number 8? Clint Dempsey.
Because he never smiles?
He looks like a buffoon.
Yeah.
He looks like a buffoon. Dude, you're not a tough guy. You weigh 150 pounds and you play soccer.
Well, think about the bright side. You won't have to see his face for another 4 years.
That's great.
That's great.
And my thing, and I think we talked about this last night, is when the national anthem's going on, the camera goes down, and I think there's 24 people on the team.
They're all singing
the national anthem. 23 are singing the national anthem. He has a stupid look on his face like he's going to, you know, do something.
So that's because
in 4 years.
you're an American tackle football coach, so you deal with tough guys.
American.
Yeah. You don't want to see a guy clowning around. But then I get it. He's got that spot on his face and whatever. You know what? We'll see him in the 4 years when we don't care about either. But let's talk a little bit, because we're going to get a little commercial earlier. We'll talk a little bit about the Carmelo Anthony sweepstakes now, which is astonishing to me that I have to listen to some of the versions I have to listen to with regards to it. For those people have never watched him play, like all of a sudden now he's going to fit in and gel in the system and he's going to be the team guy. So he made his visit today to – was it today he made his visit to Texas? He went to Chicago, right? And then he was visiting today with Houston and Dallas. And the interesting thing to me was he visits the two of the Texas teams. And the one who just won the championship wouldn't take him if they probably had $70 million in cap space to give him because they do things correctly in San Antonio. But he goes to Houston. They dazzle him. You know, big billboards with him wearing a Rockets jersey. They're going to pretend like, you know, he's going to come in. Just, he's going to deal with guys that are very easy to get along with. Like Dwight Howard, for sure. Harden, who I do like. And all of a sudden now, old Carmelo, he's just going to fit in. So are you buying into this idea that he's going to go put a championship ahead of himself?
No,
he might for a year.
Nope.
Maybe. I'm giving him a maybe for a year.
Yep.
But if you sign up for 6 years, you know, you're going to get years worth of terms because that's exactly what he'll be like. He'll be just like he's always been. So you want him on your team? You want him with that? You're a Knicks fan.
No, I'm a Knicks fan. And again, I'll be the first one. I'm a huge NBA fan. I used to, in high school, I was a big NBA fan. That maybe because the Knicks were good in the mid-90s. Maybe they've been so bad, that's why I'm not anymore. But I always get annoyed when a guy like Carmelo, a guy like, you name it, and it's not just basketball, any sport, but more so basketball. I want to win. Okay, instead of getting paid $20 million, why don't you get paid $10? If you're all about winning, you can't live on $10 million a year. Now you can add three or four more very, very good players. You know what I mean?
I'm sure
you got millions in your bank account already. You're going to make a couple million a year on endorsements. You can't live on $10, $12, $15 million a year. You have to live on $20, $22. Can you answer that, Dan?
Do I get an answer to that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I watched some of the ESPN coverage, and I'm watching, you guys might know what they but he was in the Portland front office when they selected Greg Oden over Kevin Durant. So immediately anything he says, I don't even want to know about it. He signed off on fucking taking Oden instead of Durant. But then I was watching him on this draft board thing or free agency board thing, moving around where the cap space is going to go if you sign Carmelo. So in Texas, he didn't get him to take less because of the no state income tax, so he would actually be getting just as much as he would be getting if he went to Chicago or wherever, right? Then they started talking about you'd have to move Chandler Parsons because he's making six. So now you're moving a viable piece of your puzzle. Real, I love it, watching that guy play. Then we're going to have to get rid of the kid who's in the second year as the W thing is eluding you right now. We have to move all these parts around. If he goes to Dallas, they got to move this guy. And then you start looking at him and you go, so you're just going to go off the Heat model, which really, am I going to talk about it? You got three guys of, you know, very good players and the greatest player in the world to work together, which was the biggest piece of what he did, was get those guys to say, you know what? Let's work together and win together. Now you're going to, you want me to buy into the fact that Carmelo, Harden, and Dwight, Dwight's never been happy anywhere for a minute he's been there. They're just going to all of a sudden gel and get along. I mean, to me, I said it last week on the show, if he goes to Chicago, I could see it more because I think Rose, if he's healthy, is the guy who will go, you know what, I could score 28, 30 a night. I'll score 21, and I'll go from 9 assists to 12 assists, I'll give up some of that to win. And Joakim Noah shoots like about 97% from the floor, so he doesn't even need 25 shots to put points up. So to me, like the real deal, you want to win and be able to play the way Carmelo likes to play. Chicago is the only place that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Going to Houston, I just think that is throwing a match into a gasoline tank, hoping it doesn't blow up. I mean, how does that ever work out? Harden's at least probably the most...
I think he's the most underrated player in the NBA right now.
Oh, he's certainly up there. And I think he's going to be by far the most unselfish player out of those three.
I think he's James Harden.
Out of those three, I'm talking off the court with what they say. He said all the right things. He said all the right things when shots were taken away from him. He did. He said, I'll try to get the big hole of the ball. I'll try to do this, I'll try to do that. He's still jacked up a shot. Do you remember what he looked like in the playoffs? Oh, I don't remember what he looked like.
He's atrocious. That's why I'll never say that guy's underrated. He was a disaster.
I remember,
it wasn't like one game and John Starks didn't make a shot.
So your argument that if he goes to Houston, that's good.
No. I'm not a big Melo fan at all. The only thing I want to point up is just this point that Moose made about like why won't he take $10 million? The players union never allow that. You could take a discount, but you can't just be like, I'm going to take $1 million because they don't think as a collective. The players union put so much pressure on them to say you are a top five player in this league. You can't just come out and just take an absolute pay cut to half of what your value is.
No,
they'll never have.
But what did they do when the big three got together?
They still are making a lot of money. They're not making $10 million. You can take the pay cut to some extent if you can kind of justify it and say, well, down here, they're going to pay income taxes and that. You can't just say I'm making $10 million to bring in other people.
I just threw out a number.
Yeah, I mean, take it.
Yeah,
right.
Don't be so upset.
Right. Yeah. First of all, he could technically do whatever he wants. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I think
you could, but they have their proof contract. I honestly think if they came in with some crazy contract, there would be some conclusion. Yeah, I don't think the NBA wants this thing. They want it to go down. Don't forget, A-Rod was ready to go to the Red Sox and was willing to take a pay cut to go there, and the players union blocked that. Granted, the players union in Major League Baseball is a lot stronger than it is in the NBA, but this is a big business thing where they're not going to just allow people to just manipulate contracts and do all of that stuff just to suit their own needs. Because they're always going to look for the greater good of the NBA and the greater good of the players union. And there's going to be players, mid-range players, or whatever, like, well, how's my agent going to go ask for $12 million when Carmelo's making $10 million? There's a lot of pieces to it. It's a business. So I don't think you could just come and just say, I'll take whatever, just give me a championship.
When Bosh, Wade, and James all started in Miami, did they take 14 and change?
I thought it was 16, but now Wade is set to make like 20.
No, I know.
So it's just for, I mean, it was like, you know.
But at that time, they could have all, if I remember correctly,
they could have made more.
They could have all gotten 5 or 6 or 7 million more had they signed somewhere else. So to that point, I agree with you in the sense that Carmelo's definitely not going to take any kind of pay cut. You know, going to a state income tax-free team would help him, you know, take less, quote-unquote. But the fact of the matter is, he's going to want what he has coming there. Bend his way, it seems, everywhere. I mean, he could have done things in Denver. He could have tried to move things around, but instead he said, no, I want to go to this big market. I want to be the big guy on a big team or whatever. So all the Nuggets do is play better basketball than the Knicks since he left. So to me, the idea that he needs to get the max deal, he does. If he can get, what can he get, 22.5?
Yeah, really.
Okay. If he took 18, 19.
Yeah, something like that. I agree.
That's fine.
And I think that's the type of discount that Phil was talking about.
I think that's Moose's point.
Yeah, you could just take a little less.
I don't think he's, I would have thought this point even said to players or anything. He's not going to take 8. He's not going to take 5. Right. He's not going to take a one-year, $1 million deal, even if the players union would sign off on it. He's not going to do that. I don't blame him. So it's like rather than try to figure out how the Rockets, just for example, could max you out and then have to get rid of Chandler Parsons, why don't you look at it like a knowledgeable basketball player and say, you know what, I'll pay 3-4 less. Still pay income tax here.
Yeah.
Keep Parsons because he adds something to the team. He's athletic. He's a good defender. He keeps the lights out. Then we'll go in. But it just seems to me like he doesn't care.
I think the more surprising thing, and this is more of a question for Moose, who's a Knicks fan, and you mentioned it, you asked him the question, but I just think that, like, the Carmelo Anthony, like, where is he going to go thing, I don't ever want to say a guy's not going to ever win a championship, but I don't see him being the centerpiece of a team that ever wins a championship, because the biggest comparison I think he made on the show last week was he's kind of a bigger Allen Iverson. But except Allen Iverson was a great defender. He had the ability to turn it on and be a great defender, Carmelo hasn't even shown that. So he's a scorer. I don't see him ever taking a team on his back and winning a championship. So as a Knicks fan, I just don't understand the infatuation. Wouldn't you much rather free all that money up?
I said that from the beginning.
But there are Knicks fans that are just fighting to say, oh, you're a Carmelo hater, you're a Knicks hater.
Yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, I don't understand. I hope to God as a Knicks fan, he signs the max contract with the Knicks.
I hope he goes. Let him go. And the Knicks are going to be bad this year.
Yeah.
Let him go. And don't make any huge – suck it up for 1 year. Because next year's free agent. I said this, I think, to Dan last week, maybe a sophomore. I said to somebody, Kevin Durant is going to be a Knick. Not this season, this season now.
You think so?
Yep. Kevin Durant is going to be a Knick. I'm telling you right now.
Well,
you know, Josh Jackson is going to make some huge splash. Huge.
Well, I think, well, I mean, and if Carmelo goes, they're going to do their best to get LeBron.
Yeah, LeBron. Well, I think that that's the, without a doubt, thing the Knicks should 100% be doing. I think we talked about it a little bit last year, last week on the show. But that's what they should be doing. And I don't know, I mean, once the other two of the big three opted out, which means all that means is they're taking a break, especially Wade. Because Wade's never going to get the money he was guaranteed on the free open market the way he is right now.
Did you hear what they were doing? They were discussing their contract.
Yeah, by themselves, yeah.
Which,
yeah,
which like, means that there's no way the Knicks are really going to get it.
Right.
Like, you can talk about whatever you want.
I know, but just the fact that, like, if I was like Pat Riley, well, no, I want to be in the top six. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I know you can do whatever. To me, that was just like.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I mean, I could see the thing about Durant and what is like the allure of Durant is the fact that he signed the extension in OKC before he needed to and didn't hit free agency and didn't do all that stuff that he could have done. But I do think that if they're not making a run at the finals next year, eventually he's going to say, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be Karl Malone or something like that. It's like this great player. And he is a great. I mean, he's got the same all-around player as LeBron, but he's also not a one-way scorer, just like Melo. He's a much better player.
He's my favorite player in the NBA, and it's not even close. Kevin Durant.
I wonder what Tony. I mean, Tony D, obviously, is a
former producer.
Former producer, yeah.
Yeah,
he's now a producer. He used to be, but I would just wonder what that would do. I mean, Durant would be the kind of superstar.
He would be your.
He would.
Remember
when fill the shoes? Oh, anybody who's going to fill the shoes of like Derek Jeter? There's nobody on any of those local teams I think that could do it. I don't think. I mean, you could say Eli's an extent. Eli's nowhere near, but he's still going to have his detractors. He would fill the shoes of Derek Jeter. Be so beloved. He's a lovable guy and a great player, but he's so likable.
Remember when Carmelo came? I really think this would be bigger than that.
Way bigger.
Bigger than Carmelo coming.
Especially if it was like, it had this down year, whatever, you know what I mean? They start this rebuilding process, and it's still there, and still honoring contract and all the rest. Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. You guys talk about the Nets yet?
We'll get into that in a little bit.
So, can I just, I'm not even going to stay online, so I'm going to go back upstairs a little bit, but the idea that Jason Kidd, after the season he had, coming in with all that money they spent, well over the cap and all that rent, went into Prokhorov. Basically, he's going to go to Prokhorov no matter what. This guy who spent more money than any other owner by far, with the luxury tax and all the rest, and saying, coming in as a sixth seed in the East, which was awful. You're going to come in and say, I need some control of this organization. He probably was like, just let him go.
Yeah.
I'll take nothing for him.
Get out.
Can you imagine? Get out. I mean, that is a
plan. Got nuts on doing that. Or do you, because then there was another report coming out that there was tension between them. Do you think that was Jason Kidd's way of getting out?
Could be.
You know,
those are for Milwaukee.
Yeah, have fun.
Have fun.
Yeah.
You don't got Monte Ellis out there anymore. I mean, to me, that's like a slam dunk. It almost makes the signing of Jason Kidd, which on this show, I wasn't a fan of from the beginning. Because you're bringing in all these pieces to win now. You can't bring in a coach who's never coached anywhere.
Right.
Never coached at any level.
I said that too.
I said, there's no way that, I mean, it's a complete roll of the dice, which when you spend all that money, it made no sense. Why are you put all these pieces together, let's make this run. And then the most important job you're going to have is adding this coach, and then you're going to say, let's just give a guy who's just played in the NBA, who never coached a minute at any level in his life, we're just going to hand the keys over to him. I hated this in the beginning, but the fact that they turned that around to 2 pick around pick, which there's a chance one of those guys turns up to something that's slam dunk.
Yep.
But it shows you how stupid the Bucks are. What did they see in Jason Kidd's performance as a head coach this year? And I watch a lot of that game. What did they see that he brought to the table for the Nets that's worth giving up anything? You just want to sign him because he's out there? All right, fine. But how are you giving up assets to bring in Jason Kidd? What did he show you? How could he have done any work? How could he have done any work becoming a 6 seed with that roster?
I
said the only value that I could see him, the only reason I kind of see this is why we're doing it is let's see what he does with Darren Williams. I think Darren Williams has regressed every year as a net, and he regressed even further under Kidd. He was like non-existent at times. He didn't score a point in one of the playoff games. Yeah.
So what, I mean, to me, his one role was to say, I'm this, you know, first ballot Hall of Fame point guard. I led this team, this organization. I'm going to, under my tutelage, you're going to go back to being a top three or four point guard. He is now a non-factor as a point guard.
Didn't he retire his jersey, too? Or is that from the Raptors?
Yeah, yeah.
years in the league. So he's a respected figure. I always think, a lot of time than we thought from the Johnson. But a lot of times, the guys, you know, played in the league seem to get more respect from the players. He's a good signing, but the fact that Mark Jackson's out there and the fact that you could reach out to a guy like Ewing was surprising me that they didn't try to go that route.
Yeah, Lyle Holland was the guy they added. They added him this morning. So, yeah. Still.
He's got big money.
Yeah.
4 years, $20 million. Did I hear that correctly, Tony?
I got to look it up. I don't know what he got.
So, do you think with Ewing, because he's been around, and it's obvious that he wants a coaching job, he hasn't been on interviews. Do you think he just goes into interviews and maybe just doesn't know what he's doing? Because you think he would get a job somewhere. Because he's been in a system for so long. Like, I would think that's so important. That's why I would be down. And I think that there's nothing, I don't care how many years you play in the NBA, there's nothing you could gain from being on the bench at the post, because dealing with timeouts, dealing with those, like, the last 10 seconds of a game kind of, like, you know, just craziness that's going on, there's no way you could detach yourself as a player and be like, let me just see, in this moment, what am I doing at the post? There's no way. And Coach K even brought that up. He said his first coaching gig ever was in some D3 school. He was, like, 23 years old. And his, like, third game, they were 2-0. They were all excited because it was new coach. And his third game, he called a timeout. They had no timeout, but called from a T.O., called from a T, and they lost the game. The tie game, he called a timeout and cost them a, gives them a T, whatever. And so he's like, there's nothing you can gain from those moments. If you could know ins and outs, X's and O's and all this stuff, but in-game managing and all that stuff, and I thought that was where it was evident early on in the season. He was not making adjustments, Jason did, all the rest. Patrick Ewing has spent like a decade on the bench,
right?
But that's what I'm saying. You think he goes in and
he's got to play an awful interview,
and he just goes, but you know what? There's probably a million guys who are great interviewers, the guys who always be posted, named
Jason
and the rest.
But
like,
that's what I'm saying. Like, he's got to be like, there's something going on. That a team.
I agree with
you. Take a flyer, but you know what? Because he was applying for, like, I think, like, the Vancouver job back when
they were in Vancouver, and they're like, now, Pat, we got to sign quick.
Yeah.
I've never understood it. I mean, I heard for years, like, Rick Barrett, all fan player, unbelievable player. He supplied the job, and then there was a guy who commented under the cloak of anonymity and said, he is such an a-hole. No one will even consider hiring. He's such a pompous guy. He only never struck me as though he would be that way. And
no.
So it's amazing. And for years, you know, maybe it still is. And on some level, it was always the black and white issue. But you see how many African American coaches there are in the NBA, and you go, you know, I don't know about that. But I mean, the fact that maybe they just reached out to you.
They could have.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't know. But the fact that he wouldn't be brought in earnest and really sat down and you talk with him, because again, you guys mentioned, like, you could be a great interviewer and not know the first thing about coaching a basketball team. You could be a guy who goes in as dumb as a stone. You get on the sidelines, and you know the game, you know what you're doing, you know how the interpersonal relationships you have with players, which is just as important these days, the money these guys make, is actually knowing X's and O's and knowing the tactical side of things. That's what a guy like Joe Porter was so good at. That's what I'm guaranteeing you Popovich is so good at. If there's anything they miss, X's and O's or moves-wise, they deal with their players well. And I have a hard time believing that Patrick Ewing wouldn't come in with this just label of, we're going to respect this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He's an elite basketball player in the history of the game. And like you said, he's paid a dude. I mean,
there's
got
to be a respect for the veterans that are like, this guy sat around. And it's almost like Herb Williams can't get a job. All he just fills in as the interim guy until they find somebody better. Like, what is wrong with him? What is wrong with him as a head coach?
Well,
he hasn't been given a full-time head coach now.
I never understood. I mean, didn't he get the interim for?
He got the interim twice, I believe.
Right.
But then they're just like, it was never a thought that this guy could stick as the head coach.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, we got Herb here, and he'll just come in and fill in.
Yeah.
God bless him. And Herb go, you know, to the end of the bench. So it's amazing.
And, you know, you hear stuff about the elite player. We talked about Doug Williams a couple times. Like, just couldn't figure it out managing, you know. But there are guys that have broken that in the NBA. I mean, Lenny Wilkins is a guy. He's in the Hall of Fame as a player and coach. Mark Jackson was a very, very good NBA. So,
of course,
you know,
yeah. I think that baseball is a little bit different. I just think that the job of a baseball manager is so almost irrelevant. I honestly think that you can get just about anyone in there anyone that has played the game, understands the game, to handle in-game, all of that. It's all about managing the players. So, giving little tips here and there. So a guy who is, like, so good, like Ted Williams, he's not going to manage players because he's not even going to deal with a guy who doesn't understand. Just sit back on a open slider and drive the other way. But basketball, there's a lot more to it. It's not, I don't think a head coach is really teaching guys, moves down the paint as much as they are managing in game, implementing a system, that type of thing. So I think there is a difference. It's almost a great transition here. I don't know if we need to take a break.
Yeah, we do.
I want to take a quick break, and we can transition over. What I want to talk to you about is why I've been ranting on this since literally before he became the coach, the manager for the New York Mets, and that's why Terry Collins, by the end of this weekend, needs to be fired for the Mets. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They were in rioters, what we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. Is anyone out there?
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.Weebly.com.
All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys, Mike Palma, Dan Cantarella, Sony Ireland filling in this evening. I wanted to talk a little bit about Terry Collins. I've been ranting and raving about how the guy stinks, and I don't need to go into the details anymore about why he stinks. And the name that's always been about right now is the AAA coach, Wally Backman. And there's detractors, Wally Backman, he's a fiery guy, this and that. And here's the reason why Wally Backman should be the manager, and it's very simple. Very simple. It has nothing to do with – I have no idea what kind of manager Wally Batson is. I really don't. But to me, a manager does not bring that much to the table in terms of Major League Baseball. It really does. Managing people, like you talked about Joe Torre, managing bullpen here, there are decisions you can make. I don't think Matheny's a great coach out in St. Louis, but then he goes and takes the team to the World Series. So that's all I know. Don Madden, you can question a million different things he does with his bullpen, with his lineups, how he handles people. But still, his team's going to go to the playoffs this year. The reason why Wally Backman should be the manager of the Mets is very simple. The Mets fans have been clamoring for it for how long? At least a year, probably a year and a half. Let's get him in there. So that gives the front office and the organization almost, and the team, even the players, this ability to just take a step back and say, the fans demanded this. That gives them a year to kind of, nobody can bitch. Nobody can bitch about our manager. Nobody can bitch about this and that because they demanded it. And I think that's a big thing. He's going to take the attention off of Sandy Alderson and his awful moves he's made in the bullpen and these trades where he brought in these prospects like Wheeler or Syndergaard and Darnold that haven't panned out. And you can say what you want about Wheeler. He's had some flashes. Syndergaard's been garbage this year. He's got an ERA over 5.5. He's been garbage. Everybody wants to say, remember, they were cheap for not bringing him up. The guy's not major league ready. He's not even close. So all these things, you take the pressure off of all that. This idea that they're going to win next year is not based in reality with the teams they have. But it takes the pressure off. It brings the attention to Wally Backman. The fan can't sit there if he comes in this year or has a bad start to next year and say, fire Wally Backman. When they've been sitting there on every message board in the world, calling into every radio station in New York, saying we got to bring him in. You know what I'm saying? And to me, that's half the battle with being a manager is taking the attention off your players and taking the attention off your general manager and all the rest. So bring them in. This idea that that's not a good idea, and if he doesn't pan out, and there's also this prevailing thought that the organization doesn't want to bring him in because they have this fear that he's going to do well, and they really don't like him because he's kind of a jerk, while he's back, he's a jerk. If he doesn't pan out and it goes all of next year, and then 2016 is this year where you're building, you have these guys, you like DeGrom today, had a tough first inning and has worked it out. They've got this pitching staff. That you have somebody spend that gives you an idea, okay, we gave him a year, he's tough, we'll bring him whatever we want. But there's nothing that Terry Collins is doing to add to this future or to this anything that the Mets are trying to do. Now tell me why I'm wrong, Dan.
Well, I understand your point.
Everything about it is ironclad. That's why.
No. I mean,
what about it do you dislike the most about what I did?
Well, first of all, I love Lonnie.
Okay.
I think Wally Backman's a guy that plays.
One of those, yeah.
You play the game the right way for him. You're probably never going to have a problem.
Right, yeah.
You know, you could be a career 260 hitter back in 220 to April, but you run through all four. Doesn't care. Like, you know, we talked 2 weeks ago about a kid like Adam Eaton. Like, that's a kid that could just make hay playing for a guy like Wally Backman. So, I understand what you're saying. You shut the fans up. Fans are pissing them off about a million different things. And, you know, understandably so. I've said to you before on the show, I watch a lot more of the Mets than I do the Yankees for National Baseball, so I do watch them. I just can't help but wonder, having said that, I would love to be back him up because he's kind of got, he's like the Ronald Reagan of baseball. You go, what the hell is he going to do today? Like, you just never know what he's going to do. The minute you wake up, you go, this is a hard wheel. You know what he's going to do.
Yeah,
he's crazy, right? So, you bring him up. He likes to fire on the backside for the Mets. For whatever that's worth. You know, if it makes a 70-win team, an 80-win team, it's a hell of a deal. All I wonder about is, because we don't have any of the facts, maybe there's something Alderson and the draft know about him that they say, you know what, he brought David Wright to him, or he's upset this guy. Maybe they'll say it's all his fault, but maybe there's something.
But
other than David
Wright, who do you care on the Mets roster?
No, you probably wouldn't, because you could be right. Maybe
I think a guy
Alderson's
like Harvey would love him. Harvey's a guy that's like, wouldn't get out of the field.
I don't think a pitcher of Harvey's caliber would have a problem playing for Billy Martin or Wally Jackson or whomever. I don't think a guy like David Wright would have a problem playing for him. He plays in the right way.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is maybe it's not right. I'm just proposing ideas here. Maybe it's Alderson. This is too big of a fish to fry here. I bring him up. If anybody needs spotlight taken off,
it's Alderson, that's what I'm saying.
But maybe Alderson looks at it like, this dude's going to come in and be bigger than the Mets, or he's going to come out.
They probably think he's going to be Bobby Bowden.
In what way?
In the fact that he was the
debacle.
Well, yeah. I mean, they but even if that's the case, my point is, what is the downside? The Mets are an irrelevant joke.
That's all I'm saying.
So what's the downside? How can it get any worse? What's David Wright going to do? He's got his long-term contract.
No, I mean,
what's going to happen? Like, there's no downside. There's nothing that Terry Collins is adding. Young guys are not getting better under him.
So you can see that maybe there's a downside we haven't thought of.
We should think about it. We're sitting here on the radio. We should think about it. What is the downside? There should be some downside. I don't see the downside of it. Because how could they be much worse than they are right now? And even if they are worse, to me, the Mets are in damage control. They have this plan. It was supposed to be 2014 was our year.
Right.
They used this Harvey injury as an excuse, even though the Marlins, who are not nearly the team that the Mets are outperforming the Mets, and they lost Jose Fernandez. They are able to sit there and be a viable team you could watch. But the Mets lose Harvey, and they're like, well, that gives us another year. We've got to be next year.
Think about this story, right?
I want to hear your story.
I see an interview about the the crazy Bronx bomber, the Billy Martin bomber.
Yeah, late 70s bomber. Bronx burn.
So here's Fernandez playing on that team. And he gave an interview where he said, Martin expressed and told him, so-and-so is breaking balls not working. I don't want to see a single breaking ball call. I don't want to see one breaking ball. Flat, not breaking, no breaking. So he goes, they get behind the dish the next inning. Put down the sign, basketball, no. Off-beat, change-up, no. Breaking ball, that's what he wants to throw, right? Martin doesn't say a word. He comes up to bat, next time he came up. And he goes, I have a tape sign. Every pitch for my entire at-bat. And he said, that's my story for why Billy Martin was hard to play for if you weren't Reggie Jackson. Now, the Mets don't have to worry about that because they don't have a team full of 7 months into Reggie Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
Like all these wolf beaters. All I'm saying is maybe on some level, that's what my proposal would be for the supposed downside of a Wally Backman is maybe he would have that in him. Because I think he's going to have a lot more Billy Martin in him that he's going to have Mike Matheny or Joe Mass. I mean, he's going to be
– How does the Yankees relate 70s do?
Well, he did great. But the problem you have with that is guys like Reggie found ways because he was just so good. Thurman Munson said, I don't care who's managing the team. I'll just play the game when I want to play it. He had Guidry. He had all these great players, right? The Mets are in a situation where you're talking about 2015, 2016, 2017, and you go forward and you go, we're going to be calling guys. At some point, these guys are going to probably have to get a shot at the big league, or it's going to be
I don't think Syndergaard, before I say it, Syndergaard's not going to, he's not projecting to be a major leaguer this year.
No, but you see what I'm saying? At some point, if it's not Syndergaard, if it's not Dendeth, or if it's not whomever, it's going to be another wave of guys.
Brandon Nimmo.
So it's going to be somebody, right? Maybe they feel like, you know, if Batson does come in, maybe to your point, maybe if Batson comes in and does a good job, he's going to be here. We're going to have to ink him now. Long term, he just won 78 games with a team that should win 70 or whatever. Maybe they feel like he's the wrong guy to have at the helm.
But
if he knows he's going to get rid of Collins, I felt at the time, maybe you agree with this, I felt at the time Collins was a stopgap.
He was a
stopgap. He caused problems everywhere.
He
caused
problems
in Diego. He caused problems with Houston.
But the one thing he could be adding value is that some of these young guys could be getting better under him. And none of them are.
No.
Guys come up with all this promise. They have a...
Do you think they're getting better under Mike Socha? Right now, if he's managing the Mets, I mean, do you think it's that much of a discernible difference?
Oh, yeah.
Clearly?
Oh, yeah.
So you're blaming it?
I don't blame it on him. Because it's not Mike Socha's out there. I think if you get a guy who could develop young talent, you get a Joe Maddon playing for the Mets, I think you'd see Kirk Nieuwenhuis should be a full-time player. I think you would see those type of things. Lucas Duda would be a guy who would be projected to get 28, 30 home runs.
You know how I feel about Lucas. Well, it's upsetting me every time I see him playing. He's not playing. He is, other than Wright, he's the most fun guy for me to watch.
And that's what I'm saying. So, like, to your point, to counteract your point of, like, there is some downside to it. To me, the core of the Mets is very simple right now. There's three guys that if they're going to make a run in the next 2-3 years, there's three guys that are, to me, unmovable, which leads us to our next topic, maybe. It's going to be Wright. It's going to be Granderson because he's locked in. And to me, it's Daniel Murphy, even though now they're all just talking, they got to trade Daniel Murphy. All three of those guys, what they have in common, other than the fact that I love them as baseball players, is that they're professional baseball players. And they're not going to, they're going to give you the answer that Thurman Munson said, that I don't think Daniel Murphy's going to care. This guy hasn't smiled in the 5 years he's been with the Mets. He doesn't care. He just wants to go hit his 1,000 balls in the cage and just hit missiles everywhere and hit 300 and doesn't care who's coaching him. So those are the three guys. And I think David Wright's the same way. David Wright has hits his, you know, hits himself to the Mets. Like, look, I signed the Lions long-term deal. I didn't even go test free agency because I want to be a Met. He knows that he's going to do whatever he's told. And Curtis Grant is the nicest person in America. So what's he going to do? The rest of the guys, you're either going to get better or you're going to be gone. And now, so I just think that, I have no idea what kind of manager. Wally Beckham could be the worst manager in the world. And if he's the worst manager in the world, then they stink, and after next year you get rid of him. But it buys the Met organization some time with the Mets fans, not just completely. Mets fans hate the Mets. I'm going to tell you right now as a Mets fan. And I'm a guy, I'm the most positive Mets fan you know. But they hate the Mets.
But that's honestly true of just about every fan base I've ever seen outside of Cubs fans. Like, Cubs fans come to the park, they come to the rigs if the Cubs stink, which they usually almost always do. They come to the rigs when the Cubbies are good, like they were in 5, 6, 7 and things like that. The deal is you blow everything off, you come back to the guys you mentioned. I'll talk about Wright, I'll talk about Murphy, Granderson, Harvey, those kinds of guys. The question then really becomes, who do you want at the helm? Because the Mets seem like a team that are in the ocean without, you know, got a boat without a rudder. Like, I mean, you want to start believing that here's the direction they're going. They do the take the trade, they bring in pieces, right? You're talking about the guys that are not materializing. Darnell was hitting when he came up. I don't know what he's doing tonight. So he looks like maybe he's going to show some signs of some things. But at some point, and you're the guy who's the Mets expert, it seems as though there needs to be almost a grenade thrown into the organization and things reassemble. So with that being said, with that's been my opinion as I've watched the last couple of years, you need to figure out who you want in charge of the post-Collins, what's probably going to be a likely rebuild of sorts, which probably Mets fans don't want to hear, but that's probably what it's going to be.
Yeah, it's going to be a rebuild of the rebuild. Didn't work.
Yeah.
We just say that Sammy Olson rebuild didn't work. When are we going to just fade out?
Well, there's a great article in the Post 2 days ago about Alderson needs to do here what some of the things he did in Oakland. When they recognized that a mistake was made, they would cut ties with the guy. Or they would eat the salary and say, no, we just have to get rid of this guy. And the article was essentially about Chris Young. The article was essentially about guys like him, guys like Eric Young. It was about Lagares not getting his playing time. It was about things of that nature. It was right up my alley. We were talking about Juan Lagares saying, if there's a guy who just needs to be in that lineup, that needs for the purpose of providing some excitement, even if it's
and you find out what you got.
And you find out what you got. They call up Ben Becker. Like, he never really was in there, which is shocking to me. Like, the article is basically saying, you know, you got to get Chris Young out of there. Eric Young was that in, like, 219 or 220 at the time of the article. But well, Garrett should be in there. Ben Decker should be getting some burn. You got to play Granderson and you're paying him a bolo.
And
send Omar. You start to hit and you find out what you have. But when Collins is gone, you're going to need a manager to be responsible around that rebuild.
And don't you think
maybe it's not happening? Maybe somebody knows something that we don't.
Why hasn't it happened? Like, what is the point of letting Collins wither away this year? Why not? Because the thing that the only thing I could say with some confidence about that is at least he's coached all of these guys. He's been down with the Mets organization for the last several years. So these guys know him, for better or for worse, and they got to the major league going through him. You know what I'm saying? And they had success. I mean, you look at some of the numbers that, like, Tim Decker or, like, Nieuwenhuyzer, or then these guys have put up down playing for Wally Backman. I mean, they know him. So what do you think he would say? Juan Lagares is a legitimate player. I've seen him. He knows him better than Terry Collins does. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, but, you know, if you get down to brass tacks in regards to Wally Backman, you got to talk about he had a situation with his wife, right? Where he wouldn't need to buffer up or something like that.
He's a horrible human being.
No, okay. There's all those YouTube videos of him
throwing
screaming and yelling
at his
players. Okay.
And
you had this deal where, forget, I think he was managing like independent league or something. He actually had a trailer he lived in and would have like cookouts after the game, and he slept like outside the right field wall. Now all I'm saying is I don't care about him. If he could come in as the Cubs and he could promise me they'd be close to a 500 team, I would sign up for the shenanigans and everything. Maybe the Mets brass, maybe the Wolfpons look at it and go, you know what? It is going to be a storm. Of you know what, in terms of when he gets here, those YouTube videos, all this stuff, we're just getting over this freaking Ponzi scheme that we were involved in, all these things. We don't need to be the clowns again.
Okay.
Maybe you go that route.
It's the two World Series the Mets ever had in their franchise history.
Yeah.
You got to admit, the 69 team was lovable, like out of nowhere.
They were the Cubs, but they were good.
Right.
Those are different.
Then you had the 86 Mets, who were these coke-flowing, drunk,
Playing, destroying,
having sex with girls in the locker room mid-game,
yeah.
Playing cards. Why don't you just admit that that's their Mets, like, MO? You got to be, for the Mets to win, that's like what the Mets have been since 62. They've always had this weird cachet. And it's like you bring in Sandy Alston, and they've always tried to convert themselves to be something they're not. And they brought in Willie Randolph, and we're going to cut down the facial hair. We're going to be the Yankees to the Queens.
No music.
And we're going to shut down. Jose Reyes cheers for himself too much. We got to do all these little things. And what has happened under that whole – guys, what has happened when they bring in Sandy Alston? He's Mr. Tweeting about his freaking dog or doing – he's like Mr. like dry humor guy. The Mets, it's something that you can't – you can't quantify. But the Mets are this team that when they succeed, it's because they're these freewheeling, we're not supposed to be here, or we're just insane people who are going to, just chew tobacco where it's like dripping down our face, and we're going to light each other's shoes on fire, and we're going to just drink till the game starts the next day, but we're going to win 108 games. Type team, but why can't you just embrace it? That's what the Mets are. That's what the Mets fan base is. You go to a Mets game, it's all different than going to a Yankee game. It's always been that way. Why not just understand that that's how you win games in Queens? It's just, I can't explain why that is. Bring in Wally Backman and go back to being the 69 or 86 Mets.
Well, then you not only bring in Backman, then you bring in, like, Roger McDowell, then you're pitching coach, and you go back to those days. But you also have this straight-laced former Marine general manager, Sandy Alderson, and we've all been around Marines. I mean, they're wild, crazy dudes, but there's a straight-laced way about them. I don't think Alderson's going to find a fan. I mean, he's certainly not stopping Mejia from wearing a bear out of the washroom. And he's not stopping guys from being, I mean, Murphy looks like he just came out of the wilderness, most of the time. And then you got the face of your franchise, with Harvey on it, it's David Wright. who is more of a clean-cut All-American kid than David Wright?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I see
his point. But there are pictures surfacing of him playing beer pong. Like,
absolutely. But the thing I love, and we talked about in the fall, the thing I love about watching that Red Sox game right there was just this grizzled way about them.
Right.
I love baseball like that. I'd be all for it. But I don't know if growing out your beard, drinking beers, getting funky on planes and doing weird stuff necessarily correlates with the Mets starting to win again. I mean, it's a route you could go. The question I would have is, further down the road, like, you bring Batman in for a year and a half, 2 years, fail. Teams right where they are now. I mean, then at that point, would you be saying, let's go the straight and narrow route. Let's bring in a Don Mattingly, Mike Socha type of individual. I mean, where do you go if Batman comes in and is a nice? Is it just all about the kind of manager you have, or at some point?
No, I think if he's a nightmare, even if he's just so, this is what the beauty of the idea of what I'm saying, because I think the Mets are in damage control where they got to appease the fans. And I don't think that professional sports teams owe it to the fans to appease them, but at this point, they're putting a bad product on the field. This takes the pressure off them to be like, okay, fine. Even though, you know, there could be some ability to bring him in, like, baseball-wise, it gives them, like, you guys made it. And if he fails, midway through the next year, they're, you know, 20 games under 500 at the All-Star break, and they're a joke. You fire him, you bring in an interim guy, and it gives you that little buffer, like, hey, we tried it your way. Now we're going to do it our way. Because, look, this idea that all of a sudden the Mets next year are going to be a playoff contender, how are they going to do that exactly, Dan?
Well,
how are they going to be a playoff contender?
Sandy Alderson also has
to be. Sandy Alderson needs to get fired.
His role. Getting shorter. I don't know about you,
yeah.
But just looking at Wally Backman's backstory, I don't know if I want to put my career in Wally Backman's hands. Maybe it's along those lines. I mean, if I'm Sandy Alderson, I'm looking for a guy who comes to the ballpark in a little suit and tie. And I'm looking for Buck Showalter.
Well, then you get. Why didn't he fire Terry Collins yet?
I don't know.
So I agree with you. Why didn't he fire Terry Collins from the track work that he's had with the Mets? They have not been good. They were better under Jerry Manuel. That's just a statistical fact. And you can say all you want about the talent they've had. He dealt with a million injuries. They have not done well. They have not progressed at all. In any stretch of the imagination, you can make every excuse you want for Terry Collins. But you're not going to tell me that Terry Collins have made the Mets any better.
I would have never hired him.
I wouldn't have either.
I mean,
I was against my first article for the website.
Think about it at the time. You go, we just talked about what he did at the game. Mo Vaughn was one of the guys, wasn't he? That he's so upset. Wasn't Mo at the top of that list? Mo off the own ball? He goes to Houston. He upset 50 different guys down there. And then here comes Sandy Alderson. And all of a sudden, he's the answer. I mean, that doesn't make sense. And at some point, we can sit here and talk about Collins, which clearly we have. But
he gave him an extension.
At some point, Alderson has to be responsible because it is these are his personnel decisions, both with coaching staff and on the field. So, I mean, I don't know where they go if they decide to get rid of Alderson.
And a half, 2 years defending Sandy Alderson. I'm like, okay.
How do you feel about that?
I feel like an idiot. Like I was made to look like an idiot. I don't like to be wrong, but I do admit when I'm wrong.
I know that.
Say that I admit when I'm wrong. And I defended this guy because I'm like, look at some of the deals he made. Beltran for Wheeler, and he traded away R.A. Dickey. I mean, we all made fun of the Toronto Blue Jays for that trade, for this R.A. Dickey, and we're getting back the stud catcher and this lightning arm that we got back, and oh, my God. And R.A. Dickey's just going out there winning ball games out in Toronto. Toronto is going to make the playoffs this year. And what has Noah Syndergaard or Travis Darnold done for the Mets?
Well, you know my thoughts on Darnold.
Darnold stinks.
Syndergaard in spring, there were flashes. You didn't see.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even know what he was up over.
5'7", actually.
So,
5.7. How's that? For our guy who's supposed to be the savior. That every Mets fan, when I sit out, everybody made fun of me. And we had callers even. Richard Huntington said I was an idiot. When I'm like, it's not just a strictly money thing. This guy's not ready to pitch in the major leagues yet. And then look at what he's done. There's no reason to bring him. He's not ready to pitch in the major league. The guy's 22 years old, and look what he's doing. He's pitching at a 5'7 level in the Pacific Coast League. What's he pitching in the NL? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was asked, and, you know, we've had the kind of comparison between being a Cup fan and being a Mets fan. We've talked about some of the hardships and franchises in Dory, but I've been asked not that far back. I mean, my buddy, I posted a clip about Chris Bryant, that he was the first homer, the first at-bat got to play. My buddy, who's a fantasy crackhead, asked me and wants to know, you want him to call it Baez and Bryant? I said, absolutely not. Are you crazy?
Why?
It makes no sense.
Yeah.
The team's going nowhere. The team's going nowhere. So I said at the time, back in March or April, when we started having our preseason baseball assessment, I said, if you're a Mets fan, you just want prospects up just so you can watch them pitch.
Because that's going to, I think, it's going to drive people to the ballpark. It's not.
There's no point for any of the Mets fans that believe that a 90-95 win season, that was stupid, okay? It'd be like me believing that in Wrigley Field. So seeing Chris Bryant producing a Triple A makes me happier than seeing Junior like hit the big league right now. Because it gives me hope. So for Mets fans, it's like, you know what? You're talking about the awful season. Think about that. Let him have his struggle. Let him do it. Hopefully he comes to be, you know,
right,
4 or 5 starter, whatever he becomes. Get himself right. Get to the big leagues where hopefully he can keep an ERA under 4 or something like that. And you'll have something. You'll have something. But the idea that a Cubs fan would want to call up Bryant and Baez right now, when Baez has, I think, 700 strikeouts down in
Pennsylvania.
So I don't get that. Just so I can see him play right now, I'd rather watch Darwin Barney.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was
to make air.
No, I mean, if I was a Mets fan, I would rather watch whoever I'm going to put on the mound tomorrow night pitch. I don't care who it is. And have his struggles, but he's a big guy.
It gives you the hope of at least we have this guy. Well, if they come up and he thinks, you're like, what happened to my hope?
If Syndergaard comes up and thinks what you now have, two lumps of crap. Because you're looking at Darno's at like around 200, and you're going to be looking at Syndergaard when you're at 10, going, we have nothing.
Yeah.
You're going to wait for Montero, or you're going to wait for something else. But you need hope as a baseball fan, because it is such a farm system-based game more so than anything else. So you need to be able to look down on the farm, even if it's the A-ball, the rookies that just got drafted.
Yeah.
Check and see what they're doing.
Yeah.
The Schwarber kid, I mean, yeah, I'm like, he just hits bombs. That's all he's doing in rookie ball, and you go, this is great. Maybe he's 3 years away. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it does.
But if he's hitting 350 in A-ball in a couple of weeks, the last thing I'm saying is bring him on. It's dumb. So for Mets fans to say it, it's dumb in Chicago, it's dumb in New York, it's dumb everywhere.
Yeah.
Let your prospects develop and hope you have something.
Can we make the listeners happy and bring Coach Ireland back on the show? We'll bring him back on. I'm going to take a quick break. He's going to take over the mic from me.
Yeah.
All right. And we'll take a quick break. Whatever Coach Ireland wants to talk about, the Lord only knows what we're going to be talking about. It could be high school tight end of the FCAC. I have no idea. But we'll be right back. We're back in about a minute. We're trying to enforce that.
Black is back, and only at Quiznos. It's the Black Angus on Rosemary Parmesan. Quality, thick slice Black Angus steak topped with melted mozzarella and cheddar. Try it. You're going to like it. Quiznos. Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. Toasty.
How do you make a tasty sub? There's the Quiznos way, and there's Wrong Way.
Hello.
Quiznos uses meat sliced fresh daily. Wrong Way uses shingle-packed meats in a bag. Quiznos uses bread made especially for toasting. At Wrong Way. And now, fresh out of the Quiznos oven, is our new peppercorn parmesan turkey with bacon sub. Only $3.49 for a, what the? For a limited time only at Quiznos.
We're back. Tri-State Sports Guide. I'm here alongside the coach now. After the great Mike Palmer, gracious in his presence for a while. We talked a little NBA free agency, some Nets. So our Nets fan listener, probably listener.
I was going to say, why do you make that plural?
Thrilled. He's thrilled about it. That we give you guys that a little bit. Well, right now, it's just going to be kind of a mixed bag. I mean, I want to bring up a little point from the Yankee game today. So we'll get into this a little bit. I'm watching a little bit of the Yankees today. And for anybody that doesn't know or that doesn't follow, and they have not been scoring runs lately. I think they scored 3 today and losing to Tampa. So Sheriff got another boo-boo. So he's out of the lineup, which has just become an absolute joke that he's in, he's out, and he's out. And I think I know there's the lineup put up, and Jacoby Ellsbury's not in the lineup. So I notice it because I like the guy. I like watching him play. And Michael Pick starts getting into it at the top of the first about how you can't give this guy a day off. Not today. Lions been struggling. Chair's out. It's only 30. You can't give him a day off today. And I'm looking at this, and they flashed him in the dugout, and he did. He looked exhausted. I mean, he looked as tired as a 30-year-old baseball player can look. It was their 83rd game of the season today. He's played in 80 of them. Okay, so we're not talking about a guy who's Mark Teixeira here who's missing games by a handful. So he gets his day off. And then Michael Kay has the gall to say that they even give him this day off on the weekend of the 75th anniversary of Lou Gehrig's great speech. The great, inimitable Lou Gehrig, who I think every baseball fan loves, whether they think it or not. You can't give Ellsbury a day off, but the whole argument, and he was so excitable about this, that I'm watching it going, I honestly can't get over this. I can't get over that because on top of it, he says, all Joe Murray does is protect his play. That's all he does. But you can't protect him here. And he kept saying, Joe will never tell us why. Well, isn't that part of the point? Maybe Ellsbury got to the park today. Maybe something bothered him. Maybe something happened. Or maybe Joe said, you know what? Come hell or high water, I'm getting my guys their days off. Maybe he scheduled this a week. Maybe an after night game, I'm resting. You have any issues? You're a Yankee fan. I mean, you have any issues with Ellsbury getting a day off today? And the 75th anniversary of Lou Gehrig on the 4th of July giving that speech have anything to do in your mind with Ellsbury getting a day off today?
No. Let's just start off by saying Michael Kay's an idiot. If I ever became president of Yankee operations and Yes Network or whatever, the very first two things on my list would be to fire Michael Kay and fire Steve Ball. They need a job. They both are terrible.
We throw John Sterling in there?
I like John Sterling. I hate his home run calls. I think they're tacky. But besides that, I think he does a good job. But Susan Waldman, put it this way. I like Susan Waldman more than I like Michael Kay. That shows how much I dislike him. I can't stand him.
Can you just tell our listeners why? Because I know the story, but I do enjoy hearing it.
I'm sure people saw it before. There was a commercial a couple of years back and about, you know, doing whatever, talking about so Michael Kay was talking, and he said, his statement was, and I never liked him before this, but this just put me over the top, and I don't know why. He's like, ever since I was a little kid, my dream was always to announce for the New York Yankees. Let me say this again. My dream as a little kid was to announce for the New York Yankees. Not to play for the New York Yankees, to announce. So that just shows how much of a dork he was in high school or elementary school, wherever. The biggest dork, probably never played. He was probably that kid that was the 12th guy in the team, got his one at bat, maybe a courtesy runner. You know what I mean? That was Michael Kay growing up, and his dream was to announce for the New York Yankees. Not play.
Yeah.
I feel like Allen Iverson, right? Not practice.
Yeah.
Not play.
Right.
Announce. When I was growing up playing in the park, my dream was to play for the New York Yankees.
Right. It should be. I mean,
right.
It's supposed to be. And, you know, it's interesting because I had a discussion a few years back about we were talking about our buddy, Sport Tiger Woods. I was talking about his swing coach, Sean Foley, and how much I hate the fact that he even works with Tiger. Because I love Tiger. I love watching him play. And then I saw Foley give an interview where he said, you know, when he grew up, he went to a golf course, and he was enamored by the game from a teacher's perspective, not from a player's perspective. You know, he didn't want to be Tom Watson. He didn't want to be any one of those guys. He wanted to instruct golfers on their swing, and it made me hate him more. When you told me that story about Michael Kay, it stunned me because every one of us grows up wanting to be Don Mattingly or Keith Hernandez, or for me, it was, you know, Kirby Puckett or Ryan Sandberg, somebody like that. And then you have this guy, and now on top of it, at least we here say we're not these unbelievable experts. Every time we talk football, whether it's on the air or off the air, I always say to you, you know a lot more than I know. Michael Kay comes across as this know-it-all, as though he's like a Bob Costas. Like Bob Costas actually walks around like telling you, like, not that he was friends with Mickey Mantle, but it comes out that he played with Mickey Mantle, and he did. So Michael Kay talking about anybody getting a day off at any time, when his caveat is, well, Joe Girardi knows the team better than I do. Well, then shut up. Stop there. The discussion's over. You said it 50 times. Girardi knows his guy, and he came to the park and he said, Jacoby just struck me as a guy who needed some rest.
Back to the idiot. Do you, like, you know, like when you were little, you know, playing wiffle ball, you would tell yourself, all right, the 5 and the 9, bases loaded, and I'm up in Yankee Stadium. Do Do you think, like, he sat in his bedroom, like, with a pen and paper, like, make pretending he's announcing that it's the bottom of the ninth in Yankee Stadium? He's a dork. I hate him.
Yeah.
I can't stand him. Oh, I hate him.
I'll tell you this. I used to pretend, in all honesty, that I was Tony Phillips playing for the Tigers. There had branches in the long, and I was pulling up, and it looked like old Tiger Stadium.
Yeah.
That's what I would do,
right.
But I didn't walk around like I was Ernie Harwell announcing Tigers.
Right.
Like, I didn't help. So with all those things you hear from him, it becomes exhausting when he comes across as a know-it-all, as though he knows about a player's level at that level, which none of them do.
Right.
So Ellsbury comes to the park, and he came across as though, how on earth is a 30-year-old who is making 20-some-odd million dollars a year, how is he tired? Well, he gets tired playing a Legion doublehead. He gets tired playing a college game if it's 90. It doesn't matter what you're playing or how old you are or how good a shape you're in.
I told you today, and I wasn't joking. When we got to, like, the 11th hole, we rode a car today, I was tired.
Yeah, and for our listeners that don't know, they don't like the Adonis.
Yeah, and I muscled through it. I got through the remaining round, but, like, all joking aside, I know the special athlete
right.
And all that stuff. They're human.
Yeah.
They can get tired.
Absolutely. And I've always kind of said it. It's not the NFL. It's not the NBA. Baseball isn't as tiring as those sports. It's just not. One baseball game is not as tiring as any of those sports. But you play 162 of them. We talked about it before. The other thing he said was, he being K goes, well, you know, how come Lou Gehrig played over 2,000 straight games? Well, I mean, first of all, there wasn't a team west of St. Louis. Okay, they took trains everywhere. Every game was a day game. Okay, there was a lot of things that went into it. There wasn't Ellsbury playing Sunday night baseball in L.A. against the Angels and then a Monday night game in New York against the Red Sox. Like, you didn't have those things. So there's no correlation between Kobe Ellsbury and Lou Gehrig in any way other than the fact that they both bat and throw left-handed. Like, there's nothing you would say about him. But here he is, and then on top of it, and I like Al Leiter, Leiter agreed with him, a former player. And I'm looking at this going, you can't possibly think Michael K is right. You can't. I know, you know, he wasn't an everyday player, but Al played. Al knows guys get tired.
The only thing is, do you think maybe they know something? Like, do they know he went out last night and just had a bender and just showed up on the, you know what I mean?
Well,
like, is there an inside thing they know that they're not calling him out on it?
No, I understand what you're saying. That could all be true. I mean, I don't know the nighttime activity schedule of Jacoby Ellsbury, but he doesn't strike me as that type of guy.
Right.
I mean, he's, you know, Bob Welch just passed away, and I just heard about that stuff about his pitching on, like, a 10-day bender as an alcoholic. So Bob Welch, when he was winning 20-some-odd games in the Open, I mean, never struck me that way. Maybe Ellsbury is out. Maybe he's doing things. But it seemed from Girardi's pregame little press conference that he talked about, like, I just saw him when he got here today. Like, you know, 9 in the morning, like, you needed the day off. So the questions were abound. Like, you're resting, your chair is injured, and now you're going to rest all the way on top of it. And I'm looking at it like, the offense stinks no matter when they're both in the line at the offense stage. They go out and score 3-1. They know the receiver's trying to walk as many people as he could, and they just can't finish any run. So to me, unless you can suddenly wake up Mickey Mantle and Lou Gehrig, then you're not going to have any offense, period, regardless of where Jacoby Ellsbury is or Altair is. And you hit the nail on the head. You go, Mike Day is just a lot. So, you know, we got to watch that. I got to listen to that today from him. And then I had to listen to, and I'm a pro Jeter guy, and I know you're a pro Jeter guy, but he goes over the top about Jeter today. As though, I've defended Jeter now for forever, but he was talking about today as though he was still this 315, 320 hitter. And that's not true. If that doesn't wake the palm up, I don't know what will. But, I mean, I'm listening to it going, okay, I understand what you're saying, and I understand. And they started getting into all the stuff about the lineup and how Jeter needs to stay second. And I do agree with that for a lot of different reasons. But do you have any problem, you turn the Yankee game on, seeing Derek Jeter batting second playing shortstop?
No, not one bit. Not one bit. But I went to the game Sunday night.
Yeah.
And the stories of the game, not the game itself, are not meant for listeners either.
Yeah.
But I thought about that because they had the lineup on the board. Who do they want batting second? All these guys. Dave Zulo, DJ Zulo, you out there? Because I see your Facebook account. Who do you want them batting second?
There's not one guy on the team batting over 300. This guy's batting 275. He's still putting the ball in play. He's doing. Who do you guys want to bat second? Who on the Yankee lineup?
I don't have an answer to that. I mean, Solarte was apparently the next, you know, Greg Nettles, and now all of a sudden he's, what, Cooper's last 15 or whatever he's doing. So, I mean, I looked at it that way that
you said this before, not to cut you off. It's not like he's batting 220.
No.
He's batting 272 or whatever he's up to now. 272 is not terrible.
Right.
And I remember, I don't know what the exact number is. Pete Tucci Sr., who's a very good friend of mine, said something like the difference between batting like 250 and 300, you know what it is? It's like one hit a week.
Yeah.
It's something like that small. Like one hit a week is the difference between 250 and 300. And he's batting 270-something, which is not terrible.
Yeah. It comes out to, I was going to explain to you, was over 500 at-bats. It's five extra hits per 100 at-bats.
Mm-hmm.
So over the course of a season, you're talking 25 leaders, duck snorts, whatever you want to call them. It's 25 of those over the course of 6 months. So.
Yeah.
You know, Mike D made the point last week and the week before, and he said, you know, he's the right-handed slap-hitter now, which is always kind of been the way he played. But I understood what Mike meant, which is he's not hitting the ball with really any authority.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also looked at it, and you know, you're the guy who's rooted through these five World Series that they won with him. I mean, this is the price you pay now this year. Is seeing him not in his best for the 20 great years he gave. I mean, so if I'm a Cubs fan. And I have one World Series, I think. So if I had five and Ryan Sander was coming up to the plate batting second, hitting 270 with two homers and every RBI Jeter had, I will not say a word. I'm stunned by Yankees fans criticizing. I understand non-Yankees fans criticizing him. But the Yankee faithful who have been so blessed, especially, I mean, you guys in your age group have been blessed. Guys like my dad who have been rooting for 60 years, I mean, how much do you want to win? So now you got a guy who's playing like a minor dud for him. And there's a lot of guys that would sign up for the year to bat 270 through June. But, I mean, where's the Yankee fan? When does the rhetoric stop about Jeter needs to get moved down? I mean, you and I play softball, and we hear it every week. Guys talk about it, like, you know, he should go home and say that and sick. I don't know if Ichiro did that. That was an analogy given to me, like, you know, Ichiro bad behavior, right? I don't know if Ichiro went and said that to Joe, or if Ichiro's just, he needs a ring. He needs one ring. So he's trying to do whatever he can do to save his team. He gets the shot. Not getting it this year yet. But, I mean, that's the question I have for the diehard Yankees fans is, all of a sudden now, after all the stuff he's done for you guys, the 34, almost 100 hits he has, not moving now?
My thing with the Jeter haters, which they, it's just ridiculous. And the guy knows a big-time Jeter hater. And, he says, according to statistics, he's the worst defensive player in the history of the game. Now, I don't know what a defensive statistic is. I really don't.
Yeah.
Is it attempts that you make? Is it a rate? Should you have gotten to that ball? Should you not? To me, that's not an accurate stat. I don't know if you know what the actual stat is. But they'll point out that he's the worst player, and this person always puts, stats don't lie.
You ever seen those at all?
Hold on. Let me finish this real quick. Stats don't lie. But when you bring up how many hits he has, yeah, but they're all slap hits. Stats don't lie. So how can you make the argument stats don't lie for defense, and the stats not even clear, black and blue, you can do this or you can't, but you can't.
I like black and blue. Black and white. I like that.
Yeah, well, we're
right.
Talking.
No.
Yeah, we're talking.
Well, know something. Well, I'm going to tell you about the stupid defensive statistics. I always think they're stupid. That is actually one of the statistics that goes into the war, overall war, which is like what it gets to this match. I'm going to tell you about Derek Jeter. I watched that guy play shortstop, and I can watch, especially center fielders, but you don't see a ball off the bat, and you're like, that guy should get to that. He seems to me to get the balls he should get to, even now.
Right.
I mean, there's some balls where you're like, ball off the bat, you're like, but so whether he has to get positioned in the right way, I mean, how does that statistic, whatever, however,
that's on
that. How do they go into where the guy's positioned?
I know.
Free pitch?
I know the answer to it.
Well, what's
like,
the,
do you really? I honestly know the answer to it. They have these guys, and Oakland, Tampa are like at the forefront of this. They will actually, they have distance measuring metrics of some kind where they'll pinpoint where the guy was via GPS and trace how far he went on the Earth's surface to get the ball. But
that's why it's tough because defense, what Jeter does well is his position before the pitch.
But it doesn't even take into account. I know this is a fact. It doesn't even take single count the velocity of the ball that he had. So you see how far he went to get to the ball, but you don't know if it was all the way out. Like, for example, today, Desmond Jennings hit the chopper up the middle. He just went down two-hand field down a little short hop, and it, you know, the ball hit maybe 20 miles an hour. He comes up throwing low, submarine, perfect strike right over to Kelly Johnson, and Jennings beat it, and Leiter goes, so just a step slow. And I looked at it like, that's a tough play for Andrelton Simmons for me. That's the thing. Leiter's got to know as much about baseball, if not way more than I do. Why is he saying that?
Maybe Jeter would have made that play when he was 25. Maybe it
should be close.
Well, but the point that he made that comment goes to Moose's point. I mean, there's no way you could put a defensive statistic on anything. I just really don't think so.
Errors you could. That's it.
Well, errors you can. Right. That's what I'm saying. There's even guys that make errors that also make great plays. I mean, look, David Wright has got multiple gold gloves. He's not a gold glove. I watch him every day. He's not a gold glove third base. He's a good third base. He's not a gold glove third base. What I meant about errors, that's the only defensive
thing. It's the only stat you can make.
That's it. But there are times when guys make errors because they're trying to make a crazy play. All that. But, like, I could see, you could watch a baseball game, watch a center fielder, and say, ball off the bat, there's no way somebody gets it. And you're like, how the hell did he get it? And case in point, you look at, like, Andrew Jones, to me, is the best center fielder I've ever seen in my life. The guy would play 18 feet behind second base and get the balls on the warning track. Jim Edmonds is up there like that, even though I used to debate with my former co, it was all about him. But Carlos Beltran used to play a very deep center field, which bothered me as a former center fielder. Like that, it almost shows a little bit of weakness, like you're not comfortable going back on the ball. But I will tell you, when Carlos Beltran was in the Mets, there would be balls off the bat that, like, there's no way he would get that, and he'd be camped under it. Angel Pagano is actually the same way. Angel Pagano is a very good defensive. Lagares is that guy now. I don't know what that means as far as these defensive stats and war and all that stuff, but anybody that watched Derek Jeter over an extended period of time is going to tell me he's not a very good, very good shortstop. I'm not saying he's Ozzie Smith or all of that, but well above average shortstop. The fact that he makes all the plays and all the rest. You ask any pitcher that's pitched for him. Like Al Leiter should know, at pitching this league, I would rather have Derek Jeter than even to this day, I'd rather have Derek Jeter than 20 of the other shortstops out there. It's crazy.
I'm a
pitcher.
The other thing that's killing me about the Jeter hate is he's all about himself. That's why he made the announcement he's retiring before the season. Mariano Rivera did that last year. What do you guys say about Mariano Rivera?
Kowalski did that.
Right.
Kowalski can do no wrong with anything
about it. The people that eat Jeter,
Chipper Jones did it.
Just hate him.
Well, the thing is, here's the problem that I have with Derek Jeter in general. Because you could never have, and we've talked about it, you can never have an honest discussion about Derek Jeter. Because you have the Jeter haters who you can't talk to. You have the Jeter lovers who you can't talk to. They want to say he's better, which one of our producers is one of those guys. He's better than Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth. And that's the God's honest truth. And there's very few people in the middle that you could, it's almost like politics, where it's like you either think that Barack Obama is the Antichrist or you think Barack Obama is the savior that actually came down from heaven. And it's like you can't just talk about the fact that they're all corrupt and they all stink. You know what I mean?
Well, he also did this deal, and it's always bothered me when I listen to people talk about defensive players in baseball, where people say, like, the reason he only made 8 errors this year is he doesn't get the amount of balls that the guys get. And so you'll hear that argument. You take out a guy like Ozzie Smith, take out a Marvin Scale, you take out like the elite of the elite
random,
right on the plane, you take out those guys, right? How many times are you watching a baseball game? This was always kind of struck me with this. You're watching a baseball game, and you would see this Scale get to a ball that was an ungodly ball he got to. For some reason, he kicks it, he can't throw the guy out, and he's charged with an error. I mean, when I'm watching baseball games, I see plays like that happen, and I go, could go on the throw of the hit.
Yeah, unless he throws the ball away and the guy gets
it. Yeah, and it goes on as a hit. But people always say, the reason Jed Lowry doesn't make that many errors is because he doesn't get to the ball that Andrelton Simmons gets to. And I've always been amazed by it because when the great shortstops get to those balls, they're so unbelievable, the plays they make. They get handcuffed, they do something, they make a quick flip that doesn't get the out of second or whatever. It's a hit.
Yeah, it's not an error.
It's a hit.
Unless the guy makes a crazy throw, which those great shortstops don't do.
Yeah, because when does a great shortstop get to a ball that no one can really get to, and he like diving. He's making a back there.
Yeah, he didn't go after it, but Ozzie Smith would have had it in like
other. Yeah, I never understood that. But people say all that. Well, Gino didn't get the same amount of balls.
That's
what he makes
better than what I call.
They're stupid, but they all have opinions. And you got to listen to them. You got to listen to those opinions. Immediately, I listen to Roger all the time, and I'm not even a Yankee fan.
Well, that's what's
always amazing. I have to listen to them. I'm like, I'm defending the guy who
I really try as a Mets fan, although I do hate the Yankees, and there's guys in the Yankees that I hate. I do try, because I like to debate more than anything. But I don't like to debate from the point of, like, if I didn't know that. But I don't like to debate from the point of, like, just absurd things. Like, this guy thinks that I don't hear anything about it. I like to, like, actually have a discussion, which is why Jeter is the guy I would love to debate him. And I think we talked about it either on the show or off the air. They're like a guy that you could have a legitimate discussion in the Yankees hierarchy where he should be compared is Yogi Berra. Yogi Berra is the best comparison to Derek Jeter because he could pick the ring and throw him out the window because they both have a million rings. And you can look at him, they play the defensive position, normally have great offensive stats, and so then you can go from there. And you look at, and I would put Yogi Berra ahead of Derek Jeter for several reasons, but we don't have enough time to go over that now. That's a debate you could have for 5 hours, you could have a debate. But when you want to tell me that Derek Jeter is better than Babe Ruth or Mickey Mantle or Luke Gehrig or Joe DiMaggio, then what's even the point of debating it? And if you want to tell me that Derek Jeter is the worst shortstop that ever played the game, then what's the point of debating you? Like, you could see you listen to their opinion, but what is the point? I'd just be like, well, yeah, you got me, and I'll just take off. It's not worth my time.
Well, I mean, we talked about it last week, and I said to you, when the anti-Jeter faction comes out, and they're talking to me, and I said to you, let's say I look at the guy and I honestly go, you brought him down a second. What does that accomplish? And you said something like, well, you know, people just want to say, like, you know, I changed your opinion on it.
I
want something to pick up. But at the end of the discussion, you brought about a peg in my mind. He's still a first ballot Hall of Famer.
That's why I think I'll start to compare. That's why I always say, of course he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. And if he's not the best shortstop of all time, he's in the top three. And that's it. But I think if he's at such a high level, you can't just debate the stupid people that want to debate. If you want to debate Derek Jeter and have a real discussion, you have to debate him with Star. You want to debate him with Cal Ripken as, like, who's the better. And I would put Derek Jeter ahead of Cal Ripken. But, like, those type of things. Derek Jeter and Yogi Berra, to me, is such a good, even though they play different positions, it's such a good argument you could have and you could, and maybe you bring up something that the guy didn't think of or whatever, and none of us saw Yogi Berra play. That's interesting to me. It's not interesting to me to talk to a guy who's going to bring up some defense statistics and then say, statistics for why. There's no enjoyment in that to me. And if you want to do that, and that's what you want to call North Shore to do, then it's a long show. Because I was like, okay, fine. Whatever you want to say, sir.
I know the guy who posts that stuff, although I'm not friends with him on Facebook. He's an absolute full board.
A good bartender down at O'Neill. Cowboy. I thought you were talking about Cowboy.
The Berra Gino argument would be an interesting one.
It'd be very good.
But the thing I always do in baseball, and I think you do it in any sport, is you compare a guy to the guys that play his position, and you do, and Lewis is always in the finals when I bring it up with guys, he is a Jeter fan. Then I'll go, you know, just name all the shortstops that are clear-cut better.
And we're not going to name any of them.
No, we were talking about a few weeks ago, and we go, you know, even a guy like Willie McCovey, you can mention guys who are better first basemen than him. Lou Gehrig might be one. You know, there's guys there, you can put Eddie Murray in that discussion, but there's discussions you have, but when it's Jeter, in terms of guys we've seen, I think most would agree too, the coach would agree, we're putting him ahead of Cal Ripken, I am. I'm putting him ahead of Barry Larkin, and I've had that discussion.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, it's not even close. So if you go back to a guy like Wagner, I mean, what have you proved? Thomas Wagner was better than him in
1994.
That was to get your point that I want to hear. The guys that people always bring up, top five, they always bring up. Okay, what about Nomar? What about A-Rod?
I've always said about A-Rod that the DD's for me. That's my personal opinion. I've never said he wasn't an unbelievably fast player, but he clearly was. But it's been brought up to me, what about Nomar and Tejada? And I've said, the argument was they had better years than they had better individual years, probably multiple years.
Their peaks are better than Jeter's.
Right, but then I said, and then we get into the word, you know, that you used before, that I pretty much got off the show with compiler. And I've always had a problem with that, but someone said, you know, all Jeter did was compile over the years. Well, that's anybody with 3,400, 3,500 hits. So at some point, Tejada and Nomar hit a wall, and Nomar had all the injuries. Tejada had the PEDs, and Tejada had injuries with his back and his legs and all that crap that he went through. So is your point, like, I mean, I can point out Tony Cunizero had probably a single better season than Eddie Murphy ever had. But then he got hit in the face by a ball he couldn't play anymore. So
yeah, right.
If Mike Trout's career, and I hope it doesn't happen, because I love watching it, but if it ended in a year, what do you want me to do? Tell you that he had a better career than Kendrick Jr.? I'll tell you that he was as good as him for a while, in my mind. But you can't. Once the guy's injured, once the guy's career is over,
yeah,
and the stats don't bear out. When you look at just the basic metric stats, batting average, home run, RBI, home base, whatever applies to the given guy, I don't even put Tejada and Nomar in his class.
I don't either. And I think they were both great shorts.
They're great.
But they're not all-time.
No.
But I want to ask you, Coach, because you're, I mean, have you ever thought of the Yogi Berra, Jeter debate?
Never thought of it until you just said it. I heard your producer's debate about the other ones.
Well, it's just true.
Yeah.
So, but Yogi Berra is a guy who's clearly on that next echelon of Yankee great. Like I said, we have a million hours to talk about it, which you really could talk about it for months if you wanted to. But Yogi Berra played on a great Yankee team in a great area of baseball with million of the all-time greats. He's got three MVPs.
Mm-hmm.
Jeter's not an MVP. So it's not like, you know, the argument against Jeter's always never been the best player on his team, which is kind of a weak argument in and of itself. But when you want to debate him against Yogi Berra, how is Yogi Berra win an MVP when you're talking about who he was playing with and he was the best player in the league at that time?
I just want to bring this up because, you know, you poo-poo the Hall of Fame. You change my mind to some degree about all kinds of sort of things. But those are the same people that both of you.
Three times now?
No. I'm just saying in terms of Jeter not having one. There was a year a couple years ago when we looked it up when Moreno had that great year. And you go like this, you go, the Yankees record was freaking unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You could have just as easily given it to Jeter.
You couldn't give him three.
No,
you can't pick up three.
No, people. I'm not comparing the three. All I'm saying is I look at MVPs, I look at Gold Gloves, I look at those kinds of things differently than I did when I was a kid.
I just
now I realize who's voting on them.
I do
too. There's the same idiots voting on the Hall of Fame that keep out guys like Andre Dawson for 100 years.
I do too, but I think if we look back at the 3 years that he won.
Oh, there's no point. And I love Yogi, so I'm not trying to.
Yeah, so say, I agree. Even if you want to take it down to say, but there was. They're, you know, Jeter doesn't even have that many top five pitch. I think he's got it too. Like, he hasn't even been that close to MVP very often. So I just think if you look at what he's done in that context, and you look at what he did over the course of his career as a catcher, who was like 5-0, you know, a little guy hitting home runs, never breaking out.
And that was something that Coach Tucci had told my dad. He was driving a baseball coach. My dad never forgot it. He said, Freddie, we were looking at college and everybody goes, if Yogi Berra was coming out now, nobody was looking.
No.
He's 5'6", whatever he is. He's like about 190 at that height. And nobody was even recruiting him and MLB team was excited. But my only thing is I took some of the weight off of MVP and those press given baseball writers
We'll see you next week with Tri-State Sports, guys.